This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk, and today I'm interviewing Dolan Perkins Valdez, who's the author of a new novel called Winch. Hi, Dolan. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. It's really good to talk to you. This is a pretty amazing novel, I have to say. One that I was, you know, I was just amazed by your not only your writing, but by how you captured the story. I guess for people who, you know, who are listening, who probably don't know what this book is or what it's about, you've written about four relatively young slave women who are, most of the novel takes place in Ohio,
right,
in a summer resort where their owners go. And I mean, it's fairly complicated. It was really interesting to take them out of the South and put them in this other place. But of course, there's a lot of you know, memory and flashbacks where they talk about their homes and where they're from. But could you talk a little bit about how this novel, how you came to this story?
Well, I found out about this resort that actually existed in Ohio in the 1850s while reading a biography of W.E.B. Du Bois, and the resort eventually becomes Wilberforce University, which Du Bois taught at for a few years. So it was mentioned in passing. It said that this must have been the most unusual summer resort in America, as it was popular among slaveholders and their enslaved mistresses. So I was fascinated by that and couldn't get it out of my head and began to research to try to find out more about this place. Since the women did not leave a record, I realized that I would have to imagine myself into this very unique place and try to answer my own questions through fiction about what it would have been like to be a woman there at this time, you know, in American history, to be an enslaved woman at that resort.
Right, and you introduced, you know, just incredible, you know, it is incredibly complex, the relationship of, I mean, you have layers of oppression. You have the men and women. You have slavery and, you know, ownership of people. The relationships between the women themselves are not always clear. I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, I just found it was incredibly, in some ways, painful, but also beautiful,
mm-hmm,
because you inhabited the women in this place. Maybe, and Lizzie is the primary voice,
right,
who kind of stands in, I guess, as the narrative voice. And maybe, I don't know, are any of the people real that you know of, or did you have to imagine all of them?
I imagined all of them. I think there's only one name in the book that was an actual person, and that's Samuel Silsby, Dr. Silsby, who was the manager of the resort. I think I mentioned his name once. And so I pretty much imagined all of them. In the original advertisement, or it was a sketch broadside that advertised the resort, they had a board of trustees listed on there, and they had really prominent people on there. I think there's one Supreme Court justice, there's senators, national figures. But it was very difficult, as I sifted through people's letters, to find mention of the Southern slaveholders with their mistresses. So I decided that rather than try to chase that down, I would rather imagine it and base it on the circumstantial evidence that I found about the founding of the university and the children that they had and what became of those children.
So what? Well, actually, so the I guess again, this is, we can talk about this a little bit. That there are four women who are at the center of the novel.
Right.
Each of them is owned by a different slave owner. I think two are from Tennessee, one is from Louisiana, and they go, the slave owners go to Ohio, Southern Ohio, in the summertime, where it's, you know, cooler than where they're from, I guess, and they get to, you know, hang out and be away from their spouses and their, and the duties of their managing their plantations or whatever,
right.
You know, whatever they run, and they bring these women who are their slaves and their mistresses, and you know, you talk a lot about how each, well, at least in Lizzie's case, how she relates to the wife of her master.
Mm-hmm.
But then she and a couple of others of the women have children with their masters, and you talked a lot about, you know, her goal was essentially to protect her children, and that kind of created this a lot of the kind of dramatic tension, I think,
right.
Throughout. But what, you know, what did happen to those children, if you know anyway, historically?
Well, historically, we know that many of the early students at Wilberforce were sent from the South, and they were biracial children. And so when I looked at those early student catalogs at Wilberforce, it was very interesting to see. I would see, for example, 5 siblings named Smith who enrolled, and their hometown was listed as Clarksville, Mississippi. And I thought that was fascinating. And I know that just in the history of, in that early history of Wilberforce, they had, for example, the governor of Texas, and I don't remember which one, I need to find out, who sent his children there to be educated that were the children of his African-American mistress. So in the early days of Wilberforce, it was definitely fairly well known that the biracial children of Southern white men were sent there to be educated. And one of the other things to mention about why they, there were a couple of other reasons why they traveled north to this resort. One was that it was believed at the time, and this was sort of a national pastime, that going to take, they call it taking the bath or taking the waters, going and bathing in this mineral water, in these mineral springs, or drinking it made you healthy and could cure ailments. And so there were other resorts like this that opened around the country in the 19th century. This one happened to become popular among Southern slaveholders because of the advances in transportation that were happening at the time. So it's the heyday of the steamboat. They would ride the steamboat up the Mississippi River, get off at Cincinnati, and there was a new railroad, the Little Miami Railroad, that went from Cincinnati to Xenia, and there was a train depot there. So the advances in transportation also enabled these men to travel for their vacation each summer.
Right. I noticed that you talked a lot. You talked about that at one point.
Yeah.
And of course, the women were allowed on the train only because they were traveling with their slave owners.
Right.
And you had one really evocative scene where a free black man tried to get on this train. And this is a train in Ohio where there was no slavery. The conductor kicked him off the train even though he had a ticket and he was free.
Right.
So what you do, and I thought this was very important in the book, that, I mean, of course, this whole idea that we have of, you know, the North as being liberal and more progressive is really a misconception, I think, of history, that there was an incredible amount of racism in the North, even though there was no slavery there.
Absolutely. And you know, I will say that when I looked through, because Elias Drake, who opened the resort, was a state legislator in Ohio, and I was looking through his papers and looking through some of the notes from the state legislature during that time, and I was struck by how fiercely abolitionist many of the legislators were, and I was struck by how many of them, you know, or how passionately they opposed slavery. So I do think there's some truth to that, of course, but I also think that even among abolitionists, you had gradual abolitionists, people who believed that it should be a sort of gradual emancipation. You had people along the spectrum in terms of their, of the, you know, radical nature of their ideas. And then on a sort of everyday level, you still had those individual incidents of racism that happened, even though it is a free state. And so I think there's, you know, something to be said about the sort of general tenor of Ohio as a state, but also those individual moments and also the different perspectives that existed along the abolitionist political.
Well, that's true, and it was an evolving, you know, period anyway. That there
right.
were at that when you write this book, which I guess I should say it takes place in the 1840s and 1850s,
right?
Which is a period of growing opposition to slavery, but not uniformly. And of course, even in states like Ohio and Indiana, where the northern parts of the states might be more abolitionist than the southern parts, which
right.
were more, you know, they were on the border with Kentucky and might have been more prone to not as active
right.
opponent. And the other thing is, you talked a lot about the in this area slave catchers,
right.
And I thought, you know, that is really, you know, a powerful issue as well. That you know, that was part of the argument about slavery, was that the southern states were saying people are our property, and even if they escape, they remain our property. So if they escape into a northern state, even though you don't believe in slavery, you have to bring our property back.
Right.
And that was one of the issues that I think created the most tension between Southerners and Northerners. But as you show, there was this feeling among the slaves, even in a community where there were free blacks and white people who they may or may not trust, that because of the existence of slave catchers, even if they escaped from that resort, there was no certainty that they would be protected or saved along the way.
That's right, and that is one of the things, you know, I have a line in there where one of the characters says, how do they know who's free and who ain't, you know? And, you know, there's no one answers, nobody, you know, there's silence.
Right.
So, there's definitely that fear that one could be mistaken, you know, for the wrong runaway slave.
Right, and then this other issue that I think you really alluded to this, although you didn't really explore it deeply, but that is this idea, if you were free, how could you protect yourself from being re-enslaved or just enslaved for the first time? You know, that
right.
you might have papers to show you were free, but what if some guy wants to capture you and enslave you?
And get the reward, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, obviously there were, and of course we talk about slavery, we talk about racism in the kind of abstract about this period, but what you've done by imagining it is brought it to life in the way that it affected people in their, at least in the way that we can relate to their daily lives.
Right.
And I thought that was really powerful, you know, the love among these women for each other, but also the difficulty that they had in, you know, just conducting normal relationships. They had to be secretive about everything.
Absolutely.
And then one of them who does escape, I don't want to give away too much. I think that, you know, you want to leave a certain amount of this for the readers to find for themselves. But
right.
one does escape, and it's kind of this hopeful thing. But Lizzie has to still deal with the conflict in herself that if she were to escape, she would be leaving her children behind forever and knowing that something bad would result for them.
Right. And the other thing about Lizzie that I think probably is even bigger for her than her children is that she really believes that she loves Drayle. I mean, she has, I think, real affection for him. And even as the book progresses and she begins to see that he isn't the saint that she believed him to be, she still feels great emotional attachment for him.
Well, and I think that's realistic. I mean, again, I think there's this sense we create stick figures out of people in history.
Mm-hmm.
And what you've done is given humanity to all of them. I mean, it doesn't excuse their brutality, but they're still human beings, so that you have to look at them as full human beings and not typecast them as simply monsters.
Right.
They may be human beings who are monsters at the same time, but yeah, as you point, you know, as you show, Drayle, the slave master, I think he has true affection for her as well.
Right, so do I.
And for his children,
right,
who are his children. I mean, there's all this, it's so complicated, and obviously from a political point of view, no one could ever excuse slavery or accept it as anything but an evil.
Right.
But, you know, what you've done is entered the lives of people who are captured in that. I mean, they are, and I think that's a really powerful thing to give, you know, to give voice and humanity to people who are in that horrible situation. And of course, the women were born into that and had no, it, you know, wasn't something that they had any control over.
Right.
So I know, I think it's a great novel. And,
thank you.
I just, you know, it's hard to I think it's hard to read for some people. I'm sure that
I do too, and I've been getting emails here and there from people saying that it was an emotionally draining read, but that they couldn't put it down.
Yeah, I think I felt that way, and it's also when I've talked to people about it, because I wanted my wife to read it, and her first question was, is it going to be really painful?
Mm-hmm.
Is there going to be so much suffering that I'm going to feel bad?
Mm-hmm.
And there is a lot of suffering there. There's some that you can't get over,
mm-hmm.
because that's the nature of the situation. But I think there is a transcendence that comes about from making them human. And exploring who they really are. Now, let me ask you just a couple of more mundane questions. How did you come to name the book Wench? Because I think that's an issue as well.
Well, originally, for a long time, the unpublished manuscript was called The Women of Tawawa House, and I liked that title well enough. But then I began to think about the word wench when I got towards the end of the novel, and there's a flyer or I guess a reward poster for a runaway wench, and began to think about how that word was used, particularly for black women in this era. And when I looked at the etymology of the word, I saw that the Middle English of it originally meant young girl. It just meant a young girl. And then it changed and began to mean promiscuous or sexually loose woman, but it was only when the word entered the United States that it began to be applied specifically to black women. And so I knew from my graduate studies that this was a very prevalent stereotype, the wench imagery, which was cast in opposition to the less or non-sexualized mammy image. And I wanted to explore that idea so that we could talk about we, meaning, people who read it, me as a writer, so that we could talk about the stereotype of women, of black women historically, being sexually promiscuous. And I thought that if I titled it, that could really provoke more discussion about the kinds of positions that black women under slavery found themselves in. And so I was really pleased when my publisher agreed to go forth, because I think it's a risky title, but I use it carefully.
No, I think it is. I think it attracts attention, too. It's sort of, it gives you a sense of the complexity and the fact that you're dealing with things that are not simple and straightforward. It's not, as I said before, it's not stick figures. So I think by titling it this, I think you gave it some more depth, another layer, something that people have to think about before they pick up the book or when they pick up the book.
Right.
So I like that. And I know, so are you writing another book?
Not yet. I wish. I'm working on this book. The promotion has really taken a lot of effort, but my hope is by summer to be working on the next one.
Do you have an idea of what you want to do?
I don't. I've been brainstorming in my notebook and haven't come up with a single thing.
And I guess I should say for people who are listening, this is your first book.
It is.
So, I know the first book is often, it's pretty hard going. And how long did it take you to write?
It took 4 years.
Yeah, that's a while.
Mm-hmm.
And you teach at the same time?
Right.
Yeah, so that means you teach writing?
I do.
So you have to deal with the kind of different perspective of reading your students' work and teaching them about writing, and at the same time you have to sort of turn in completely the other direction and take care of your own work.
It's true, but I found writing and teaching at the same time to be very invigorating. I really felt that my writing picked up when I began to teach, just because I was thinking about writing a lot. I was conferencing with students, talking to them about writing. And so what I found myself doing is saying, hey, you ought to take your own advice.
Well, that's good. No, and you kind of teach yourself at the same time.
Exactly.
Then. I think that's really good. Well, what do your students think of the fact that you've done this book?
I'm headed back for a big book signing to my university in March. I'm on leave this year, And so I'm sure lots of students will be there, and it'll be interesting to see what their reaction is. I was teaching, of course, at the time that I sold the book, and they were very excited about it. But I think it's different when the book comes out and they begin to read my work, because I'm sure there are many of them who have never read my work, because I was, you know, I had never published a book before, not unless they, you know, looked up a short story or something that I published. So it'll be very interesting to see what they think, and I'm hoping that I have inspired them, because I had a lot of really talented students.
Well, and did you study writing yourself, or did you study other things and then decide on your, you know, separately to be a writer?
I did. I did an MFA in creative writing at University of Memphis. I finished back in 1998, and since then I've been writing and trying to get something going, but I really didn't feel until I started this book that I really had something that I believed in fully, and that I thought my writing craft had come far along enough for me to actually tell this story.
Well, your writing is certainly, you're up to the task.
Oh,
I you know, the writing is beautiful, and you know, to me it's always, I kind of look at it as, if I didn't really notice the writing, then I know it's good.
That's a nice compliment.
Well, I thought it was a really good book. So
I recently read a debut novel by another guy who I recently met, and it was so good. And I thought, wow, I need to get started on the second book. You know, it was one of those moments where I just felt like I needed to start over again and start working again. He was such a good writer.
Well, it is always inspiring, you know,
it
for
is.
Anybody who's a writer. You read somebody else's work. I always found that if I read something that I really liked, it made me want to respond in some kind.
Right.
And I think, you know, it's obviously much harder to write a novel as a response than it is to write a story or a poem or something. But I hope that you find the inspiration to write your next book. I'm sure you will. And I will certainly be looking for it.
Thank you.
And so thanks so much for talking to me. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Dolan Perkins Valdez, whose first book is Wench, a novel that I recommend to everyone. Thanks so much, Dolan.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.